It was just before midnight when the 747 landed in Tampa. Police cruisers and FBI vans were lined on the tarmac, waiting to escort the precious cargo to its new home. Security was tight. There was intelligence that the convoy would be attacked. The cargo was 11 elephants en route to Tampa's Lowry Park Zoo. That's how Thomas French opens his book, Zoo Story, Life in the Garden of Captives, in which he introduces us to the logistics and politics involved in running a large zoo. He was on our show in August to discuss this hidden world, and we thought that we would air that conversation for you again today. I started off by asking him, why would people want to attack this convoy?
Well, there are a lot of animal rights groups that were very much opposed to bringing in these 11 wild elephants from Africa. These weren't circus elephants accustomed to captivity. These were elephants that were used to roaming the savannah in Africa. So this idea of plucking them from the wild and putting them inside captivity was very offensive and upsetting to a lot of animal rights groups and other people as well. And there was some concern that someone would try to sabotage the convoy, not so much to hurt the elephants as to bring attention to this situation.
But weren't they in danger in their homeland?
Yes, they were scheduled to be killed. In Swaziland, where they were from, they lived in these little game parks where there were too many elephants, and they were overrunning the parks. And basically, they were scheduled to be killed to thin the herd.
So they were called the Swazi 11.
The Swazi 11, yes. And PETA's position was, one of their lawyers stated in federal court in D.C., was these elephants would be better off dying free than living in captivity. And that was a really interesting crystallization of the central tension of zoos, and I was grateful that PETA articulated that so clearly.
Well, that is part of the debate always, isn't there, whether the zoos work as conservators of the earth and support vanishing species, or whether they're also exploiting living creatures for financial gain and putting them into unnatural situations, situations that sometimes are the equivalent of putting somebody into solitary confinement in a prison.
That's very true. I think that a lot of zoos, those two situations exist at the same time. A lot of good zoos, including Lowry Park Zoo in Tampa, are working very hard to work with endangered species and species that are disappearing in the wild and trying to give them refuge, sometimes with manatees trying to bring them in, heal them, help them recover, and then send them back out into the wild, which is a great solution. But also, they are trafficking in living creatures, and there's no way around that. It's a tension that can't fully be resolved.
Although sometimes when they put them back in the wild, they're incapable of keeping themselves alive.
That's
they
true.
Have become zoo animals.
That's true. Some species do not do well when they try to introduce them back into the wild. It's a really tough situation.
You said that you became interested in researching zoos after reading Jan Martel's Life of Pi.
Yes.
Was there a particular passage there?
I love that novel, and he's such a beautiful writer. And I was reading it in the summer of 2003, and there's a passage very early in the book where the narrator, who grows up on the grounds of a zoo, he talks about life inside a zoo and the nature of freedom and some of our misconceptions about freedom and about zoos and the wild. And it was really provocative and fascinating. And I realized I've never read a really detailed nonfiction account of life inside a zoo. So I knew the elephants were about to arrive at Lowry Park, and so off I went.
What's involved in transporting elephants? How do you even get them onto an airplane?
The logistics of that were staggering. They had to first knock them out with tranks, load them into giant crates, and then sometimes loading them by cranes and sometimes with a conveyor belt, sometimes both. Then the crates are lifted into the belly of this freighter jet, and, you know, off they went. And then they're keeping them sedated inside these crates as the freighter 747 takes off. I didn't think a 747 could carry 11 elephants, but they actually told me they had enough thrust to take a couple more.
I just wonder why they don't just walk them onto the kinds of planes that they put tanks on.
That's a great question. Well, you know, elephants are extremely intelligent. They're extremely strong. It's hard to make an elephant walk, especially a wild elephant, walk, you know, onto a plane. So it is really a complicated logistical challenge.
We should read Erica Chong's Fear of Flying to them. Maybe they'll change their mind. You describe the game preserve director who accompanied the elephants on the plane. He had a sickening thought during the flight. What was that?
Well, Mick Riley is watching these elephants. And as this very long, epic flight took place, high above the Atlantic, he noticed that some of the bulls were beginning to wake up from the sedatives, and he saw them testing the strength of the crates and basically reacting against the confinement. And he had this horrible thought, this vision of what would happen if one of the bulls broke out on the plane. And he had this vision in his head of seeing this bull charge down the length of the plane, charge through the cockpit, over the pilots, and through the nose of the plane, and then it tumbling end over end down toward the Atlantic far below. And of course, now that in that vision, the plane is disabled because there's no more pilots, there's no more controls, and so the plane is following behind the elephant.
And that could have happened.
Well, they were working very hard to make sure that it didn't. But yes, I guess it's not, elephants are very strong, very intelligent animals who are very skilled at surpassing human expectations of what they can or can't do. Zoo world stories are rife with accounts of elephants doing various things to break free of electronic fences, electric charged fences. They'll short them out by tossing boulders or trees on them. When these elephants, before they got on the plane, they were in a boma, a corral essentially in Africa, and these elephants pushed a small elephant as a battering ram into this electrified fence trying to break free there. So they're very, very, clever animals.
They're willing to kill an elephant to get free.
Certainly give her a shock.
And the reason that you chose Lowry Park Zoo as your subject was simply because you read that these elephants were coming there?
Well, I thought that it would be interesting because the fate of these elephants, PETA was very vocal about what was going to happen with these elephants. And I wanted to see, well, what did happen with them after the furor and the headlines died down?
Well, how does Lowry compare to some of the other major zoos in this country, the Bronx Zoo, the National Zoo in Washington, the St. Louis, the San Diego?
Well, Lowry Park in 2003 was a respected mid-sized zoo. And they were really trying to become a big city zoo. So that process of watching this institution trying to transform itself or reinvent itself was really interesting. And the elephants were the centerpiece of that reinvention.
11 elephants is a lot of elephants for one zoo.
Well, actually, 4 of the elephants went to Lowry Park in Tampa and 7 went to San Diego.
I didn't realize that there's a national group that accredits zoos.
Yes.
Can a zoo be taken seriously without its approval?
Without the accreditation from the AZA, that's very tough for a zoo to be taken seriously. That is the major accrediting body that tries to maintain standards for care inside zoos.
It's remarkable how you've managed to make this book character-driven. Tell us about some of the animal characters at this particular zoo, like Herman.
Well, it was really a wonderful reporting challenge to delve into the lives of not just the humans but the animals. And Herman, who you just mentioned, was this alpha chimp who had had this life that it could have been co-authored by Dickens and Darwin. He had been born in the wilds of Africa, had seen his family group and his mother killed in front of him by hunters. He was then sold as an infant chimp to a human family who was working in Liberia in West Africa. They took him home, raised him almost like a human child with their children, and then moved back to the States. And eventually when Herman got a little older and was approaching adolescence, chimps can be very dangerous when they become adults. So they donated.
Because they're very strong.
They're very strong. They're also very volatile emotionally. Even if they are bonded with you and they realize that you care for them, when they're angry, their emotions just flash. So they're very, very – they don't have very much impulse control. And so they donated him to Lowry Park in Tampa, which at the time in the 70s was a terrible, terrible zoo. It was known as one of the worst zoos in the country. And then ultimately the city of Tampa tore that old zoo down, built a more enlightened zoo in its place, and Herman reigned there for decades.
Often you hope in these zoos that the chimp will meet another chimp and will have baby chimps.
Right.
He's not attracted to other chimps?
Herman was a really unusual alpha in that he had breeding privileges with the other chimp females around him. But Herman, due to his upbringing as a child or as a young chimp, really wasn't attracted to female chimps. He was attracted to human females, especially blondes in tank tops. And yes, it's one of these details. When I first heard it, that he was regarding these soccer moms who would walk up to the exhibit as sex objects, it is funny. But then the more I watched Herman and I realized how stuck he was, not just physically in this place but emotionally and his libido, he was really stuck, and he didn't know who he was or what he was. And I interviewed the family that had raised him, and it turns out that their best theory for why he developed this fixation on human blondes is that in Liberia, at this mining company where his owner worked, there would be family picnics, company picnics, and there were a lot of Swedish families working at this company, and there were a lot of beautiful Swedish women who were holding him and cradling him in their arms as a young chimp, and something got turned around inside of him, and that was it.
And he'll never get past that.
And he can't get past it. He's literally frozen in that misconception. It was almost as though he thought he was human.
My guest is Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Thomas French. His latest book, Zoo Story, Life in the Garden of Captives, published by Hyperion. You also tell the story of Inshallah and Eric. Who are they?
Inshallah was known as Herman the chimp was the king of the zoo, and Inshallah was the queen. And Inshallah was this beautiful, ferocious female Sumatran tiger who was very fierce even by tiger standards. And she had been born and raised at the zoo for most of her life and had never lived anywhere other than captivity, and yet she was not tamed. Nothing about her had ever been tamed. And the zoo was trying to have her breed with male Sumatrans because Sumatran tigers are the most endangered subspecies of tigers in the world. There's only about 200 to 300 left in the wild, and there's a good chance that they're going to become extinct. So they were trying to get more baby Sumatrans. But Inshallah was so ferocious that she intimidated these male Sumatrans, including Eric, who is a young tiger virgin who was on loan from the National Zoo.
And never got it together?
Well, I do feel like, you know, I got to watch this mating dance, which leads to this. It was really fun to write this tiger sex scene. I've never had a chance to write about tiger sex, but I watched this mating dance where ultimately they did overcome their differences and bred, but Inshallah never had cubs.
Well, it is interesting that some zoo animals can produce offspring and others can't. And is it clear why that happens?
No, and they were trying very hard to figure out what was happening with Inshallah. She was about 15 at the time I was there, which is fairly old for a tiger, and she was nearing the end of her reproductive window. But it was heartbreaking because her keepers who loved her wanted to see her raising cubs, and they wanted that just for her and for the species and for the planet's genetic diversity.
One of the most interesting characters in your book is the zoo CEO, Lex Salisbury. Can you tell us about him?
Yes. It was interesting because I was watching all these different species, the tigers and the chimps and the frogs and the manatees, and thinking in terms of power and display and alphas. So when I turned my attention to Lex Salisbury, the zoo CEO, I saw Lex in a whole different way and saw other humans around him who were working with him in a species through the perspective of a species. And Lex was a classic, very strong alpha. He was a visionary. People who didn't like him called him a visionary.
And there were quite a few people at the zoo who didn't like him.
Many people at the zoo who didn't like him because Lex, as a classic alpha, was very, very tough to work for. The nickname they had for him on the staff was El Diablo Blanco.
And everything has a nickname. All the animals have nicknames?
Many of the animals have nicknames. They have their official names that are told to the public, and then they have their house names, which are the names that sort of pet names that the keepers give them. Many of the pet names were after Naboo or Anakin or other names related to Star Wars, because there was one of the keepers who was really a Star Wars fan and the other keepers loved her, that keeper, and so bestowed all these other Star Wars names in honor of her.
You explore many practical elements of managing a zoo that we might not even consider. Like you say, elephants need constant foot care. Now, elephants wander through all sorts of different environments. Are their feet tender?
Well, what happens is that in the wild, they will wander for up to 20, 25 miles a day as they're eating, because they eat for up to about 18 hours a day. And they have – the pads of their feet get naturally worn down as they walk those great distances in the wild. In a zoo, even a zoo where they have some room to move as in at Lowry Park, it's not nearly as much room as in the wild. So there's not as much chance for their foot pads to wear down. So they build up. Sometimes they get cracked and then they get infected, and those infections can be lethal to an elephant.
And how do you treat that? An elephant is pretty big, and if it wants to stomp on you, it can really hurt you.
It can hurt you. It can kill you. Caring for elephants can be an extremely dangerous profession. In fact, for a time, it was the most dangerous profession in the United States, even more dangerous than coal mining. And one of the keepers at Lowry Park in years past, named Charlie Torrey, had been actually killed by an elephant, which is a really difficult, obviously traumatic moment for for her family and for the zoo. So what they've done since in zoos around the country is developed a different safety protocol for handling elephants more safely, where they're able to get close to them. They put them in a huge device called an ERD, or elephant restraint device, which sounds Orwellian, but it's actually just a chance. It doesn't hurt the elephant. It's a chance to put them in tight quarters where they can't move, and then there's little windows or doors on the sides of that where the keepers can safely perform foot care and exfoliate their skin, which is also really important.
Many zoos have created large open areas where they put animals that get along with each other together. Yeah. But can you always know?
No, you can't. That is a trend in zoos to sort of make it more like game parks in Africa. And I think that's
the Bronx Zoo has done.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting, good trend, because the more room those animals have to move, the better off they're gonna be. But you're right, animals are unpredictable, and sometimes in the wild they kill each other, and sometimes in captivity they'll kill each other.
And you mentioned elephants escaping. That's a major problem at a zoo, isn't it?
If an elephant escapes, it's a huge problem. And Lowry Park and other zoos have safety drills where they practice what to do if various species escape. And if an elephant escapes, elephants can be extremely dangerous. We have a very benign view of elephants. They're beautiful creatures. They're gentle often.
They appear in circuses?
Yes, but they also can be quite dangerous. And so they have to develop this whole procedures for what to do if one of these animals escapes.
I assume they shoot them with tranquilizers.
Well, there's various things they try to do, but shooting them with tranks is the best, yes. Or if they can lure them back, the escaped animal, into their enclosure with food, that's the best. It's interesting because in those moments, it is very dangerous, obviously, for the humans, but it's usually more dangerous for the animals, because if an animal escapes into a neighborhood, usually the animal is not going to survive that experience.
Mm. Or very often. You also talk about what happens if a bear escapes from her cage.
Well, they had a bear at the zoo named Ladybug, who was a very sweet bear, and they talked about how she escaped. They would just lure her back with, I think it was oranges was her favorite. And if they just put some oranges, a path of oranges, back to her enclosure, she would do predictably pretty well.
A listener from Westchester, Mary, asks if you've read Gerald Durrell, who started zoological breeding. How successful were his programs?
Well, I don't know as much about the success of his programs, but I know a little bit about him because Lex Salisbury, El Diablo Blanco, worked with Durrell in his early years, and the impact and the influence that he has on zoo practices really continues to this day. He was a very influential figure.
You write about returning to the zoo after Herman died and being disappointed that there was no monument to him. Should there have been a monument to him?
Well, there was a lot of talk. You know, Herman died in a power coup where he was because he was such an unusual alpha who really wasn't sure if he was a chimp or a human, he really didn't understand the brutality or the complexity of chimp politics. And there is a thing called Machiavellian intelligence in primates, including chimps. That's what the scientists call it. And chimps, like other primates, can practice deception and counter-deception. And Herman was essentially overthrown in an assassination. And once he was gone, it was a huge emotional blow for the zoo, because he had been reigning at the zoo for decades, and a lot of people really equated the zoo with him. So it was very hard that there is a plaque, but there was talk of more of a memorial, and that would have been, I think, very powerful.
Well, there's a picture of a chimp on your cover. Is this Herman?
I'm sorry, no, that's not a chimp. I'm sorry. That's an orangutan.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's a male orangutan named Rango.
I was associated with him. Oh, I see the long hair on the back, but
yes.
I was associated long hair with the face as well, and it doesn't seem to have that.
Right. That's Rango, who's a male orangutan.
Can you put orangutans together with chimps?
Generally, no, you do not do that. They're from different continents. That would not be something that most zoos would sanction.
Thomas French has been a journalist for 3 decades. For most of the time, he worked as a reporter for the St. Petersburg Times, where he was awarded a Pulitzer Prize for feature writing. He's now teaching journalism at Indiana University, and his latest book is called Zoo Story, Life in the Garden of Captives. It's published by Hyperion. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Leonard.